Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 99, A Vietnam POW's 5 Years to Freedom, Part 5. Last time, we saw Lieutenant Nick Rowe attempt to escape from his Viet Cong captors with fellow prisoner Sergeant Lin Tedios. The attempt failed, and the punishment was harsh, but it was even worse for Tedios, for whom this was a second escape attempt. After a week of corrective punishment, where both were confined to individual cages and kept in irons except to eat, the prisoners promised to not attempt another escape. Full disclosure, they had their fingers crossed behind their backs and were absolutely planning more escape attempts. And a short time later, they were reunited with fellow American POWs, Sergeant Dan Pitzer and Master Sergeant Ed Johnson. Though they were together again for the first time in months, it wasn't a joyous reunion. Sure, they were glad to see that everyone was still alive, but each was still dealing with various physical and psychological damage caused by their captivity. Rowe and Pitzer were also concerned about the third American taken prisoner with them, Captain Rocky Versace, who had been judged a lost cause by the Viet Cong and separated from the other Americans. About 2 weeks after Rowe and Tedios were moved back to the camp housing Pitzer and Johnson, on September 20th, 1965, Rowe noticed a curious anxiety amongst the guards, but had no way of knowing the cause. On September 26th, the guards brought a radio to the cage and told the prisoners they were going to listen to Radio Hanoi. That was something different. Apparently, there was a news bulletin that the senior cadre wanted the prisoners to hear. The signal was poor, but as the guard dialed in the station, Rowe caught the phrase, "The execution was carried out at 10 o'clock, then static, and again, in retaliation for the murder of 3 patriots in Da Nang, static, Captain Humbert Roque Versace, static, Korabak." Nick sat stunned. The rest of the broadcast was a blur of meaningless sound. Though the signal had come in broken, the message was crystal clear. Versace had been killed. Executed. And unlike last time, when it was a ruse to get the other prisoners to cooperate, this time it was real. This time it was being announced for the world to hear. In his memoir, Rowe wrote, "There was silence in our hut as the realization grew. Rocky was dead. They had executed him, murdered him. It couldn't be. Rocky and death didn't fit. He was too alive, too vibrantly alive to be dead just like that." Johnson broke the silence. "Was that the Versace that was with you?" I wanted to say no. Rocky wasn't just with us, he was one of us. Tedios looked questioningly at me, his dark eyes serious and concerned. I nodded slowly. Yeah, that was Rocky. The questions flashed through my mind, seeking a shred of logic in what had happened to him. What did he have to do with Da Nang? How could he be responsible for the deaths of 3 terrorists? Rocky was a prisoner of war, a non-combatant, unable to protect himself, and they had killed him. Tumbling flashes of thought fragments whirled through my consciousness. Rocky at Tampu, the day he got off the chopper. The baseball cap canted to the side of his head. The relaxed, happy grin. Then his anguished face right after he'd been hit in the operation. His endurance and spirit under physical and mental stress. He desired only to go back to his family, his faith that remained strong. And the most tragic of all, Rocky back in the first prison camp, as he looked up with that open, warm smile after his wounds had been treated and said, "Aren't these wonderful people?" The next day, the guards returned with the radio to make sure the prisoners had heard the broadcast. Even with the accompanying static, the broadcast was clear enough for us to hear the report of the executions of Captain Humbert Roque Versace and Sergeant Kenneth M. Korabak, carried out at 10 o'clock in the morning in retaliation for the execution of three quote-unquote patriots in Da Nang by order of the High Command of the Liberation Armed Forces of South Vietnam. Korabak was a mispronunciation of Ken Rohrbach, a member of our Special Forces team, who had been captured at Hiep Hoa Post less than a month after our capture in 1963. We had lost two friends and two good soldiers. I wondered why they would take a prisoner on the battlefield, grant him his life and demand gratitude for the act, and then take his life from him as a prisoner. The head guard, who was nicknamed Carpenter, hung on every word as I told him we had learned of Rocky's execution. He immediately asked what we thought, the question bursting forth as if he had been waiting for days to ask. Dan nailed him on the spot by saying we expected the same fate since the front's policy obviously allowed the murder of prisoners. Carpenter was shaken and retorted that Versace had been a criminal and had been punished for his crimes. I countered that we were equally guilty of the crimes of which Rocky had been accused and therefore could expect the same fate. Carpenter found his question had gotten him in a hole and began to tell us that the front regarded us not as criminals, but as misguided individuals. He assured us that the front had no intention of killing us and we should continue to progress so we could be released and returned to our families. I glanced at Tadeo, seeing in his eyes the reflection of the last months in the punishment camp, the slow death there, the near summary execution when we had been recaptured, and now this. It was a tightening vice that left a man no place to turn, no hope for maintaining the shreds of individuality, self-esteem, beliefs, without paying with your life for that privilege. The second year of our captivity ended on October 29, 1965. On November 9th, the prisoners were moved back to where they had been a few camps earlier. Back to the camp with the schoolhouse where they had received their indoctrination lessons. Roe and his dysentery, fungal infection, and beriberi, and Johnson, who was recovering from a bout of pneumonia, were considered the healthier of the four prisoners and were made to walk to the new camp while lugging lumber along with them. Pitzer and Tadeos, who were even worse off physically, were allowed to travel by boat. That Roe and Johnson were considered the healthiest Americans was evidence of how far everyone had slid since their capture. The camp had been redesigned, and when they returned, Roe and Pitzer were placed in a hut with no bars on the walls, and Johnson and Tadeos were placed in another about 25 feet or 5 meters away. In between the huts was a cage, smaller than the huts they were in, but about half again as large as the cages they had been in during their time at the punishment camp. Major Bay, the commandant of their original round of instruction, returned for round two and was almost cordial in his welcome of the prisoners, stating that they were here for an extended series of classes designed to give them a clear picture of the situation here in Vietnam, so that they might be able to realize their mistakes and thus be released to return home. I guess the old saying is true. The more things change, the more they stay the same. The prisoners entered a familiar cycle of being treated well, which led to indoctrination sessions, which led to demands to sign declarations repenting of their misdeeds against the people of Vietnam and denouncing U.S. involvement in the country. At times, they would be moved from the camp into the jungle, but they never knew why. Maybe U.S. forces were getting near, maybe it was something else. At other times, they would change camps altogether, back to ones with bars on the walls. Eventually, other American POWs were brought to join them and would stay in the smaller hut/cage in between their two buildings. The first one brought in was Captain Orion Walker Jr., the first new American they had met since Tadios joined them a year earlier. Before his capture, Walker had stood 6 feet 2 inches tall and weighed 225 pounds, or 188 centimeters tall and 102 kilograms. He was now down to 130 pounds, about 60 kilograms, and was so stooped that Roe, who was 5 feet 8 or about 107 centimeters, could look Walker in the eye. Walker had a fungal infection that was far worse than Roe's, and the others knew he would not last long. They did what they could to help their comrade, but he seemed to have lost the will to live. He stopped eating, and a month later he was dead. The next American to join them was Army Staff Sergeant Ben Wilkes, who had been kept in an all-Vietnamese prison and had been given the same rations as his South Vietnamese counterparts, rations that were more substantial than those given to the American POWs. To the emaciated prisoners, this affable, quiet, African-American soldier looked almost fat, and they were worried what the reduced rations available at this camp would do to him. Wilkes had been captured on his first operation in country, also about a year earlier. Wilkes' arrival marked the beginning of Lynn Tadios's decline. It was almost as though Walker had shown him a way out of the terrible situation he was living in. Illness struck Tadios and he was soon immobile. Not long after that, he simply stopped eating. As they had done for Walker, the others tried to care for their friend, but Tadios died on March 20th, the second POW death in 2 months. Unlike Walker, whose arrival and period of decline was so rapid that he seemed transient, Tadios had been a part of the group, and his death caused the group morale to plummet to lower depths than ever before. This man had been strong enough to attempt escape twice, and withstood the punishment for such action twice. But in the end, he reached his physical and psychological breaking point and slipped away. Following Tadios' death, Roe spent long nights analyzing his thoughts and reactions. He felt a bitterness of hatred building, feeding off of constant frustration and anxiety. He knew that such negative emotions could break him and lead to his demise, so he did the only thing he knew how at this point. He turned to the one positive force his captors couldn't challenge, his faith in God. Returning to Roe's own words, "My religious background included Sunday schools, vacation Bible schools, and church attendance as a youngster. I had never questioned religion, nor had I ever really accepted it. It was something I lived with because that's the way things were done. There had never been a time of trial serious enough to make me consciously depend on a supreme being, except when I felt some interest of mine was beyond my direct influence. Once I achieved what I had set out to do, God was given a pragmatic thank you and forgotten until my next need arose. My closest association with the development of faith came at West Point. 4 years of compulsory chapel each Sunday, the idea of having to go, failed to diminish a growing sense of peace and communication I discovered with the quiet majesty that was the interior of the cadet chapel. In the stillness of the chapel, I began to look at faith not in terms of ritual and sectarian dogma, but as a very personal communication between one man and his God. After graduation, I had no time to develop that which I had begun, but evidently the foundation was still there. I found myself returning to and drawing from that foundation in this situation where I was stripped of all material assets, leaving only the intangibles which form the core of our existence: faith, ethics, morals, beliefs. It had become a test of whatever inner strengths I possessed against the total physical control exercised by my captors. Were I to survive with my spirit intact, I could only turn to faith in the power I believed to be so far greater than that which imprisoned me. For the first time in my life, the words of the 23rd Psalm were a source of strength and consolation. From the loss of Tadeos on, I began to believe, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." On July 21st, the prisoners were visited by the first member of the Viet Cong to purport to be a doctor and began treating them. During this visit, Dr. Hai began discussing the possibility of a prisoner exchange, which got the Americans' hopes up. I mean, why else would a full-blown doctor be treating them if they weren't going to be exchanged? The next few days and the talk of going home would be the high point of 1966. By mid-August, after no action toward release had taken place and demands for signed denunciations returned, morale fell once again. On August 13th, a recently captured Special Forces medic, Jim Jackson, was brought to the camp. Pitzer immediately recognized him. They had attended a medical course together back in the States. Just as Wilkes had been, Jackson was initially isolated from the other prisoners so the cadre could try to win him over with their way of thinking before the other Americans could corrupt him against the Viet Cong. But they were too slow. Jackson almost choked on his first bite of rice in the camp. He missed the note the others had smuggled to him. When Jackson was eventually allowed to move in with the others, he was able to give them all an update on the truth about what was going on in Vietnam. Of all the U.S. ground divisions that had been deployed to the country by President Johnson, to not just advise, but to directly engage Viet Minh and Viet Cong forces, and that much of what their captors said about the imminent final victory of the front was nowhere near the done deal the guards would have them believe. The attempts by the cadre to create a picture of hopelessness for the government of South Vietnam and U.S. efforts had been fruitless to begin with, but this exposure to the basic elements of deceit had wiped out any chance they might have had to create doubt in the prisoners' minds about the military situation. Not long after Jackson arrived, Wilkes began his own irreversible decline. After being held with South Vietnamese POWs for a year in conditions much more favorable than those of Roe and his American compatriots, Wilkes was never able to adjust to the new conditions he was forced into. He had a very difficult time with his new and greatly reduced diet and quickly found his physical condition diminished. He couldn't mentally bring himself to eat the same terrible food day after day and often refused to eat anything at all. He began suffering from a variety of serious illnesses, and on January 1, 1967, he died of serious malnutrition after nearly 2 years in captivity, but less than 1 year of treatment as an American POW. Before I end today, I would like to eulogize the service members lost in this week's episode. Orion Walker Jr. was born in Boston, Massachusetts on September 27, 1933. He enlisted in the Naval Reserve in February 1951 and was honorably discharged in September 1954. After the Korean War, he attended the University of New Hampshire and enrolled in the Army ROTC program, where he was commissioned an infantry second lieutenant in January 1957. He entered active duty in May of that year. After attending the infantry officer basic course at Fort Benning, Georgia, he spent time at Fort Riley, Kansas, and in West Germany before his promotion to captain, when he was sent to Fort Hood, Texas, to take command of Headquarters Company, 1st Battalion, 46th Infantry Regiment. After company command, he volunteered to be a military advisor to South Vietnam. He arrived in country in November 1964 and was captured on May 23, 1965, in a Viet Cong ambush. Walker spent 258 days in captivity, 230 of which were spent as a lone American in a prison camp holding South Vietnamese POWs. The final 28 days of his life were spent in the camp where Rowe, Pitzer, Johnson, and Tadios were also being held. While in captivity, he was promoted to Major. Major Orion Judson Walker Jr. died in captivity of malnutrition and illness on February 4, 1966. His remains were never recovered. Today, his name is located on Panel 1 Echo, Line 124, on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. It is also inscribed in the Courts of the Missing at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Oahu, Hawaii. A memorial marker for Major Walker was placed in the Contacook Village Cemetery in Contacook, New Hampshire. He was 31 years old. In his book, 5 Years to Freedom, which was published in 1971 while the U.S. was still involved in the Vietnam War, author Nick Rowe refers to Walker as Captain Tim Barker to protect his identity and respect his family's privacy. Leonard Tadios was born on January 9, 1936, in Lanai, Hawaii. He enlisted in the U.S. Army Infantry in 1952 and served in the Korean War, where he was wounded in May 1953. Rising to the rank of sergeant, Tadios remained in the Army after the war and deployed to South Vietnam in 1964, where he served as a light weapons infantry advisor until his capture by the Viet Cong on December 11, 1964. Not long after his capture, he was moved to the prison camp where Rowe, Pitzer, and Johnson were being held. Sergeant Tadios escaped captivity in June 1965 and managed to evade the enemy for 3 days before being recaptured. He escaped again in October 1965 with Lieutenant Rowe, but was recaptured the next morning. After 463 days in captivity, Tadios died of extreme malnutrition on March 18, 1966. He was officially listed as missing in action until the end of the war and was promoted to staff sergeant before being declared dead after the war ended. His remains were never recovered. Today, Staff Sergeant Leonard Masayon Tadias's name is located on Panel 1 Echo, Line 76, on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. It is also inscribed in the Courts of the Missing at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Oahu, Hawaii. He was 32 years old. Author Nick Rowe refers to Tadios as Sergeant Dave Davila, again to protect his identity and respect his family's privacy. Given that Rowe used aliases for other POWs who died in Viet Cong custody, I assume that Ben Wilkes is also an alias, but unlike with Walker and Tadios, I have not been able to discover Wilkes' true identity. The Department of Defense has an amazing organization called the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA. I believe I have mentioned DPAA before. It's the agency who identified Air Force First Lieutenant Michael Blassi the individual initially buried at Arlington as the unknown soldier for the Vietnam War. DPAA has a database accessible online that contains the names and other information about all unaccounted for U.S. service members in Vietnam. There are currently 1,584 names on that list, including Walker and Tadios, but no Ben Wilkes. I wish I could tell you more about him. I do hope that he is listed in the courts of the missing in Hawaii and on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington. I introduced Rocky Versace back in episode 95, the first episode of this current story arc. He was taken away from Rowe and Pitzer almost immediately because the Viet Cong decided that this man could not be broken, and they were right. Versace tried to escape captivity 4 times, but was unable to get away. Regardless, he continued to resist the Viet Cong by insulting them in fluent Vietnamese during indoctrination sessions and quoting the Geneva Convention when they tortured him. The prisoners he was housed near during his final days said that the last time they heard his voice was when he was led away to his execution. He was singing God Bless America at the top of his lungs. After learning of their son's death, Colonel Versace and his wife Marie tried to find out what they could about the circumstances. Marie went to Paris in the late 1960s but was unsuccessful in gaining an audience with the North Vietnamese delegation there for the peace talks. In 1969, Versace was initially nominated for the Medal of Honor, but he was ultimately awarded a posthumous Silver Star. In 1999, Versace's nomination was re-examined, and in 2002, his Silver Star was upgraded. On July 8, 2002, during a White House ceremony, Versace was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor by President George W. Bush for his heroism, the first time an Army POW was awarded the nation's highest honor for actions in captivity. His surviving siblings, brothers Stephen and Richard and sister Trilby, were present at the ceremony. His Medal of Honor citation reads in part, "Taken prisoner by the Viet Cong, he demonstrated exceptional leadership, resolute adherence to the tenets of the Code of Conduct, from the time he entered into a prisoner of war status. Captain Versace assumed command of his fellow American prisoners, and despite being kept locked in irons in an isolation box, he raised their morale by singing popular songs of the day, and leaving inspiring messages at the latrine. Within 3 weeks of captivity, and despite the severity of his untreated wounds, he attempted the first of 4 escape attempts by dragging himself on his hands and knees out of the camp through dense swamp and forbidding vegetation to freedom. Crawling at a very slow pace due to his weakened condition, the guards quickly discovered him outside the camp and recaptured him. Captain Versace scorned the enemy's exhaustive interrogation and indoctrination efforts, and inspired his fellow prisoners to resist to the best of their ability. When he used his Vietnamese language skills to protest improper treatment of the American prisoners by the guards, he was put into leg irons and gagged to keep his protestations out of earshot of the other American prisoners in the camp. The last time that any of the fellow prisoners heard from him, Captain Versace was singing God Bless America at the top of his voice from his isolation box. Unable to break his indomitable will, his faith in God, and his trust in the United States of America and his fellow prisoners, Captain Versace was executed by the Viet Cong on September 26, 1965. Captain Versace's extraordinary heroism, self-sacrifice, and personal bravery involving conspicuous risk of life above and beyond the call of duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Army and reflect great credit to himself and the U.S. Armed Forces. While Versace's remains have not been found, there is a marker in his honor at Arlington National Cemetery. A memorial marker for Captain Humbert Roque Rocky Versace stands over an empty grave in Memorial Section Mike Golf, Site 108. Additionally, Versace's name is inscribed on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall on Panel 1 Echo, Row 33. On July 26, 2002, Rocky Versace Memorial Plaza was dedicated in his honor in Alexandria, Virginia. A statue of Versace in the plaza was made possible by a donation of $125,000 by the citizens of Alexandria. This memorial is only a few miles from the Ghost of Arlington home office, and I plan on visiting it to pay my respects in the very near future. When I do, I'll post some pictures on the podcast's social media feeds. On July 29, 2002, the day after his Medal of Honor ceremony, Secretary of the Army Thomas White and Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki inducted Versace into the Pentagon's Hall of Heroes. In 2003, he was inducted into the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. On Memorial Day 2007, his name was engraved in El Monumento de la Recordación, the Monument of Remembrance, dedicated to Puerto Rico's fallen military members, located in front of the Capitol building in San Juan. Finally, Versace's name and Medal of Honor citation are memorialized in a plaque on the side of MacArthur Barracks at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York. Similar plaques around the building honor Academy graduates who received the Medal of Honor in the Pacific Theater of Operation during World War II. Next week, we will return to the story of Lieutenant Nick Rowe, who, after watching other prisoners starve to death while being unable to do anything about it, has to find the mental fortitude to believe he will not suffer the same fate, because he has seen, firsthand, that giving in to despair leads to a path of no return. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.